Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7. Welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine. First, on Between the Covers, host Alice Perry interviews Nina Marie Martinez, whose debut novel is Ay Caramba, a story inspired by a Mexican game of chance. At 9:30, we'll hear a recent talk by Barry Lynn, executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Lynn is an attorney and ordained minister who spoke last month in Portland. And at 10:30 on stage and studio, hear a special live performance by local violinist Aaron Meyer. And at 11 on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, we'll hear excerpts of a press conference where witnesses describe the execution of Stanley Tookie Williams. Also reactions from his attorney, the NAACP, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Angela Davis. Also look at the case of Reuben Cantu more than a dozen years after his execution in Texas. A further investigation into his case has provided new information supporting his unwavering claim to innocence. And tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News featuring an interview with James Yee, the former military chaplain at Guantanamo, who was falsely accused of terrorism by the U.S. government. At 6, it's Out Loud, and at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Now here's Between the Covers.
Perry for KBOO Radio today. I'm interviewing Nina Marie Martinez, author of Caramba. Caramba is Nina's debut novel. Welcome to KBOO Radio, Nina.
Thank you.
Caramba is your first novel, Nina. Has this novel, this story, been waiting to be told for a long time, or did this develop later?
Well, it took a long time. I wrote this book while I was going to school, raising a child by myself, and basically running my flea market business out of my living room. So the first chapter of this book was written in 1995, believe it or not, while I was in community college, trying to estrange myself from being a high school dropout. And the last chapter of the first draft of this book was written on the last day of the year 2000 because it was my New Year's resolution to get it done that year. So I waited until the very last moment. So it took a long time, kind of, sort of. I mean, not necessarily if it was just the time that I sat down and did it, but since I had a lot of stuff going on. But it's kind of a strange story in that I made it all up, and I was actually very proud of that because, you know, it's one of these novels that it's not known. None of the characters are based on me, and I don't know any of these people. I just made them up. But after a while, you know, in doing interviews and going out and talking with people, I realized that it was all very much about my experience, even though it was all made up.
And it's several people's stories all at once, set in a fictional town in Northern California, and at the same time against a bi-national, bi-cultural backdrop. Can you talk a little bit about that? Or?
Well, myself, I am the daughter of a German-American mother who grew up in the Midwest and a first-generation Mexican-American father. I grew up with two very distinct families. I related more to my Mexican family simply because the parties were way better over at the Mexican grandma's house. So it was kind of my mother as a child, she recognized the importance of language and how powerful it could be. And she never wanted my father to teach me how to speak Spanish. Sure, I learned words here and there because it was cute when somebody would say, "How do you say this in Spanish?" And I could tell them. But it wasn't until my parents split up when I was 14 years old that I really got more involved in my Mexican culture. And it was quite amazing because here I had this Mexican-American father whose first language was Spanish. But growing up, he didn't really act like a Mexican man until my mother was gone. And I've seen this happen with my aunt, too, who married a Spaniard, even though people say it's the same language, it's a remarkably different culture. When he passed away, in her time of tragedy, she went back to what she knew. She went back to her culture. And my father, all of a sudden, in the absence of my mother, he was speaking Spanish. He was hanging out in cantinas as opposed to bars. He was listening to nothing but mariachi music. And ironically, he had two girlfriends. One of them was Micaela, and the other one was Graciela. And the diminutives of both are Chela, right? So he had the two Chelas. And here I was, this light-skinned girl with freckles, green eyes, and really dark hair, going, what is up with that? So it was at that point in my life, as a teenager, that I really got more involved in my culture. And I told my father that one day I would speak Spanish better than him, and he laughed at me. And now it's almost come to pass.
That's great. You mentioned mariachi. That has a central place in this story. And yet you said that this didn't come out of any real story, but out of your experience. Was it because your father reverted to mariachis, or why so much the powerful mariachis in the story?
Well, for me, I think that all my life I looked for authenticity. Coming from two remarkably different cultures, you know, you kind of want to fit into one, the other, or both, or forge your own space in life. And so when you find yourself in between cultures, you know, you choose maybe to identify more with one. So you hold on to things, or maybe you might say archetypes, that come to represent that culture. Like, there's so much in my book that's based on, like, the old Mexican movie, The Serenade, the mariachi, and those things come to have more relevance to you, because it's almost like you're grabbing at straws. You're trying to forge your own cultural identity from a past that maybe you didn't have. Like, for example, now that I'm fluent in Spanish, my dad is really funny, because when we're in the company of his friends, he always says, háblale en español, she speaks Spanish, speak to her in Spanish, because it makes it look like I grew up speaking Spanish, whereas so many children of my generation don't speak, they're not bilingual. So it makes him look really cool, like, hey, he taught me how to speak Spanish, even though that's not true. It's a cultural upbringing that I didn't have, but that we both wish that we had.
And you mentioned that a lot of people in your generation, in my generation, don't necessarily have that experience of being bilingual. They're bicultural, but not necessarily bilingual. Mm-hmm. To me, in the story, I see a lot of that in between, a lot of that limerence. So you have the bicultural characters. You have the mariachi who is a born again Christian, which is sort mm-hmm. of, in some ways, not to be expected. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose to make Javier a born again mariachi?
Well, to me, his dilemma in life is that he is a mariachi, a missionary, but foremost, he is a man. First I had this idea. I wrote this scene where two of the main characters of the book are in a bar and they're listening to a born-again Christian mariachi band. And that is what he came out of. He came out of my saying, wow, that sounds really interesting to put those two polar opposites together and see what comes of it. And in creating his character, you know, in Mexican culture, you have the macho, which is really embodied in the mariachi. But then again, most Mexican men are devout Catholics. And these two things are absolutely, totally, completely polar opposites. On the one hand, you have the macho man who is a womanizer, a gambler, and quite often a drinker. And then on the other hand, you have the man who loves his mother, adores his mother, who is devout Catholic. And, you know, on the surface, even though my mariachi is a born-again Christian and he goes around with his group of mariachis and they try to save the souls of the wayward in bars and in prisons and so on and so forth, I thought it was comical, but it also gave me a vehicle to examine the, I don't know, is hypocrisy too harsh a word? The contradiction. Let's be safe here. We don't want to offend anyone. The contradiction between, you know, the macho in Mexican culture and this devout Catholic correctness that is often handed down to us.
Contradiction is a good word. Another place in the novel you point that out is, again, when these macho Mexican-American men go to the local cantina to see the transvestite show. Tell us about Trudy and again, why that was important to show that contradiction in the novel. It's a lot about women, but it's a lot about men as well.
And I hope that's to my credit. You know, that was one of the first things when I sold my book. That was the first thing I said to my editor. I said I wanted to have a narrator that didn't sound too male, that didn't sound too female, that sounded, you know, almost objective. In any case, you know, the reason why I wrote about a drag queen is because I'm a girly girl. You know, I love clothes. My second job is I sell vintage clothing, you know. And I've always loved being super female, like, you know, having my clothes a certain way and my shoes a certain way and lipstick. And it was just so much fun to me to be a girl, or a woman, I guess I should say, even though I like being a girl better. And I wanted to have somebody who was over-the-top feminine, you know, who was just crazy about all of these things. So I thought, who's more feminine than a drag queen? And I thought that that was also a good metaphor for this in-betweenness and this duality that we have in life. We have many different places and many different roles. And also, just like I have a character who's stuck in purgatory for 27 years, a Mexican man who is forced to learn to speak English by the low-ranking saints and angels that run the place. Because that is also kind of a space, the in-between space that I have occupied my whole life, being from two distinct cultures. And I think that immigrants often occupy the same space, and the children of immigrants, because we have the dominant culture into which we are either fighting or trying to assimilate into, and then we have the culture of our parents and our grandparents that we are trying to hold on to. And so that is this duality is really a theme that is manifested in the mariachi. It's manifested in the drag queen, and also actually in most of the characters.
And you mentioned the character that's stuck in purgatory, Don Pancho, and he's really enraged as he's trying to get out of purgatory. He's really enraged that he's being forced to learn English and that he's being poked fun at by these, like you said, angels and low-ranking saints. And he's been a womanizer. He's kind of met a tragic death as a result of some of that, but also plays an important role through dreams, through his presence in dreams of two or three of the other main characters in this book, his daughter, her best friend, Consuelo Natalie. Tell us about their friendship. Tell us about Don Pancho's role in their lives and in Lilibel's.
Well, for me, I think I wrote about friendship because when I was a kid, we always only lived somewhere long enough for me to make really good friends, and then we moved, and then I lost them. So I never got to have that lifelong female friendship. So you know how some people, mostly kids, have imaginary friends? Well, this is my imaginary friendship. That's what Natalie and Consuelo is to me. And then there was Don Pancho, and it's amazing to me how many people just love him and how many people relate to him. I had my uncle's ex-wife come up to me. And this is a woman I haven't seen since I was a little kid, and she hugged me and she said, "You know what, mija, you tell your uncle that they need to read this book and they better behave, otherwise they're going to end up just like Don Pancho." Now, his story is that he was what we call a parandero. He liked to drink, he liked to womanize, and he liked to gamble. He ends up getting hit by a train. So, in certain parts of Mexico, they believe that if you are buried in unsanctified ground where you died, that you can perform miracles, that you are a tiradito, or a little castaway, and that some of these tiraditos can actually perform miracles. So he ends up in purgatory because he didn't exactly behave himself well in life. And he ends up having to solicit the help of these two women, first his daughter, because he needs someone to come to the train tracks where he was killed and to pray for him so that he can get out of purgatory. Well, his daughter's afraid of public transportation and long car rides, because so she cannot go to Mexico to help him, so she sends her American friend, her gringa friend, we can even say. And she is the one who is successful in extracting him out of purgatory. And when he goes to perform miracles, he ends up being the patron saint of drunks and prostitutes, because he says, well, everybody needs representation. He plays a small role also in Lulabelle's life. Lulabelle is my mariachi's mother. He comes to her in dreams, and she says, look, you know, you're in purgatory, and I really want you to get a message to God for me, because I haven't talked to him in a long time. Because Lulabelle is this divine woman, and she thinks that, you know, the devil and Jesus are men like any others who will naturally desire her but inevitably leave her. So she kind of goes back and forth between the devil and Jesus, metaphorically and symbolically, but also in her own mind. So she solicits his knowledge. You know, she says, you're in purgatory. That's closer to God than I've ever been, you know. Can you ask him a question for me? But she ends up answering that question herself in a very different way.
And she early on in her life has a tragedy that kind of puts her back into this strained relationship with God. And do you think it's those moments of crisis, either cultural crisis, being stuck between two cultures, or the crisis of losing a child, that puts us in those dual roles, or is it just a fact of everyday life? Are we all in those?
I think it's natural, but it can certainly be a catalyst. It certainly, for example, in Javier's life, the born-again Christian mariachi, the reason why he decided to become a born-again Christian mariachi was because as a child he didn't know his father, so the only male guidance he got came to him through the men of mariachi and the prophets of the Bible. So through that, he decided to unite his two great guiding forces. So I think that tragedy and loss can be a catalyst to higher understanding, to at least an opening up of the thought process.
In the novel, and as you know, as we've seen today in our interview, Spanish plays an important role in the novel, and yet I think this goes beyond just being a Mexican-American novel or mm-hmm. a Chicano novel, as great as those are and as much as I appreciate them. What about this novel do you think transcends just being placed in one cultural or two cultural contexts?
Right. You know, like I said, I'm a high school dropout. I ended up going to 6 high schools, actually, in 2 years, and that was the real reason why I dropped out of high school. But I was there long enough to get that talk. And I don't know if they still give that talk, but it was in a literature class. And the teacher said that literature is about conflict. It's about man versus man versus nature. And we can substitute woman, but back then they said man.
Right.
Man versus God, against himself, against the elements, so on and so forth. These are the themes. These are the quote-unquote great themes. And when you are dealing with these themes, I think that it should appeal to all humans. Just like I can show you my bookshelf and I can say, okay, this writer is from Russia, and this writer is from here, and this writer is homosexual, and this I recently read a book by the Icelandic Nobel Prize winner. And, I mean, we read things from all over the world. And I think that if you are writing serious fiction, it's about those universal things, those intangible things, and that it should appeal to all people, not just from your culture.
And those intangible things, those universal themes, another important structural part of the book is the loteria cards.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell the audience a little bit about the loteria and its significance in Mexican culture, but also how it relates to those universal themes, how they relate to those universal themes?
Mm-hmm. People see the loteria cards and they're really pretty, and all of you out there have probably seen them. And if I showed you one, oh, those, I've seen them, they're everywhere. People think that they're divining cards, like tarot cards, but in fact, they are just basically Mexican bingo. But instead of having just a number, you have an image and a pithy saying that goes along with it. So at some point when I was writing this book, it had 11 main characters. And I was one of these odd authors that I already had an agent before my book was even done. And she said to me, "You know, sweetie, in this country, unless you're a white male, you don't get to publish an 800-page first novel." And I thought about 800-page novels that had been published recently. And I thought, well, Thomas Pynchon published one, you know, several years ago. He's a white male. And I thought of, well, more recently, Jeffrey Eugenides, which is an absolutely wonderful book, Middlesex, one of those, like, 600-page books that when it's done, you're, like, reading the back cover wanting more. I said, oh, he's a white male, so I think she's on to something. So I cut 5 characters and ended up with a novel with 6 main characters, which, you know, as you know, Alice, we're Latinas. We have big families. Well, I'm an only child, but I have a big extended family. And we know people who have big families.
Yeah,
we do. We're used to dealing with lots of characters. That's easy for us. But I thought, you know, maybe I need to organize this book somehow because it is a novel with 6 main characters. And how will I organize it? So one day I'm looking at the loteria, and there's the músico, the musician. I have a musician. There's the sirena, you know, the sexy, the topless mermaid with the long hair, you know, on the open sea. And I thought, I have lots of sirenas in my novel. And I just check, and I thought, well, this would be a wonderful way to organize the book, and it can be a tale told in turns of the card. So when you open up the book, you have a page that says, "This book contains." Because you know how when you buy a board game, it says "this box contains," so you make sure you have everything? So the idea was that it was sort of like a game. And I think the real thing behind it is that, you know, the universe is playing a game with us all. You know, there's a higher something at work here. And that in this novel, these cards are just sort of being pulled out of the hat by this anonymous hand, which you can say maybe the narrator, the omniscient narrator in the book. And that was the structure, and that how it was like kind of born of necessity, or at least in my own mind, I felt that it was necessary to organize it in some way.
Well, and it's organized in a very beautiful way. I'd like to ask you to give the audience a taste of this novel so they can see what they're in for when they read it.
Okay, I'm just going to begin with the beginning. We start with like-minded individuals. Natalie and Consuelo were best friends since the second grade, when the latter stuck a piece of ABC gum in the former's hair while they were engaged in a fistfight over a boy whose name neither of them could remember. When Natalie had to cut her then waist-length hair up to a chin-length bob, Consuelo followed suit. Both girls realized at the early age of 8, a man is the last thing that ought to come between friends. On a Saturday night, Consuelo called Natalie, not for any of the usual reasons, but to inform her that she had just killed a man. This scared Natalie even more than the time she was shoejacked by a mental ward escapee who'd made off with her favorite pair of platform slides. Consuelo forewent the details, but implored Natalie to come quick. Natalie ran to her closet and pulled out her favorite dress, which was long and black with spaghetti straps, and her favorite sweater, a pink mohair cardigan with pearly buttons. She threw on a strand of faux pearls she had bought after watching Breakfast at Tiffany's on late-night TV. Trouble she normally wouldn't have gone to, but it was a Saturday night, and if it really was true, if Consuelo really had committed the crime she had spoken of over the telephone, then it was all the more reason why the girls ought to have a good time while they still could. On the way to Consuelo's, Natalie considered herself lucky to have 8 cylinders on her side. She had worked every summer between the 2nd and 9th grades, either picking or cutting apricots, and sometimes both, in order to earn enough money to buy the car of her dreams, a 1963 Cadillac Eldorado. As she pulled into Roscoe's to fill up, she was struck by a sense of pride and sentimentality. In that day and age, as well as any other, a girl needed all the advantages she could get, and Natalie was happy to have a car that was on the one hand beautiful and elegant, and on the other responsive and powerful, characteristics she strived for in herself. With that sentiment in mind, she eased into the full-service island and said to the attendant, "I'll take a tank full of super unleaded, and be sure to top it off, please." Common sense in the movies told her that when two girls go on the lam, a full tank of gas is an essential starting point.
Thanks, Nina. And that was two of the six central characters in the novel Caramba, Nina's debut novel. Nina, you mentioned that you were a high school dropout and that then you went on to college to earn your bachelor's in literature.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Well, I started out bachelor's in literature. It started out that way. I was studying literature at the University of California at Santa Cruz. I'm also a single mother. And so here I was living in family housing. I had a 1,000-square-foot apartment with hardwood floors and a view of the ocean. I had child care if I needed it, and so on and so forth. And then one day somebody told me that if I switched my emphasis to writing, I could stay a year longer. So I thought, oh, okay. And it was there, even though I had written a few chapters of this book, it was there that I wrote 300 pages of this book.
Well, that sounds like a good way to do it. And you're working on your second novel now,
right?
Is that correct? So we can look forward to more. Can you give us a...
Okay, I will tell you. My next novel is called Swap Meet. It's about a girl who gets taken to the dump, her first full day of life, because it's on the way home from the hospital and the truck was already loaded, who has a horrible childhood and then grows up to be the queen of the swap meet.
Oh, I can't wait.
I can't wait either.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning at KVU, Nina. We hope that the audience has enjoyed this interview and that that they rush out to pick up a copy of Caramba, Nina Marie Martinez's first novel, and we look forward to your second.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks, Alice. It was fun.
Great.
Viva la vida. Que ayer se fue.
listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned at 10:30 for Stage and Studio. D'Mae Roberts features a special live performance by local violinist Aaron Meyer. And now, a recent talk by Barry Lynn on the separation of church and state.
Hi, this is Kenneth James for KBOO. The following is a lecture from Reverend Barry W. Lynn, delivered at Portland State University, November 7, 2005, and recorded by Charlie Holzweisig for KBOO. Barry W. Lynn is the Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, where he has been the director since 1992. He's a member of the Washington, D.C. and Supreme Court Bar, earning his law degree from Georgetown University in 1978, as well as holds a degree in theology. Reverend Lynn frequently lectures and participates in debates, and KBOO is pleased to broadcast this lecture held at PSU. The lecture will be preceded by a brief introduction from Tom Simonson, current president of the Columbia chapter of Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
Hello. Thank you very much for being here tonight. My name is Tom Simonson. I'm president of the Columbia chapter of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And I'd like to make a quick introduction of Barry to explain a little about him and his background, and then with no further ado, he'll begin. Reverend Lynn is Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a position he's held since October of 1992. He's a member of the Washington, D.C. and Supreme Court Bar. Reverend Lynn earned his law degree from Georgetown University Law Center in 1978. In addition, he is an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ, who received his theology degree from Boston University School of Theology. He's an accomplished speaker and lecturer, appearing frequently on television and radio broadcasts to debate and discuss First Amendment and separation of church and state issues. Numerous television shows, as I imagine many of you who have seen, radio, and he is also an author co-author, actually, of The Right to Religious Liberty, and writes frequently on First Amendment issues in publications such as USA Today, The Los Angeles Times, and Wall Street Journal. Without further ado, Reverend Barry Lynn.
Broke this already. They can turn it up. Hey, how many of you were actually there in Vancouver this afternoon? Okay, well, that page of jokes right there. Hate to repeat myself. Okay, so we have established so far that I am indeed both a minister in the United Church of Christ and an attorney, which of course means I can forgive you but sue you anyway. You know, it is really nice to be in Portland. I must say that because I come, of course, from Washington, D.C., which frequently feels like an alternate universe to every other place in the United States. And you can get a kind of hint of how strange Washington has become by doing a simple experiment on your own. And that is to go home and go sit at your television set using your remote control device, switch between watching the House of Representatives on C-SPAN and then flip immediately to the Cartoon Network. And if you can tell the difference, you're better people than I am. The other, peculiarity recently in Washington is that we have just nominated to sit on the United States Supreme Court as an Associate Justice a man who believes that the government cannot regulate the private ownership of machine guns, but can regulate the private reproductive choices of women. So when I say I'm glad to be in Portland, I'm glad to be in Portland. You know, the other good thing about Portland, I've only been here for about a day and a half, but there's a very good, what those of us who survived the 60s might call a good vibe in this city every time I come here. That's right. And because some days I don't have a good vibe when I come to places and I do my work. For example, I opened up my email a couple of weeks ago and I got this. It says, "All I can say is that Barry Lynn is not a minister. Well, maybe of Satan." This guy has less brains, that's a grammar alert for those of you in the English business, than anyone I have ever seen. What he needs to do is shoot himself. And please shoot your family first, because we do not need people with your genes breeding. You know, Yeah, well, it could be. I mean, and the other thing about communications, if Tom DeLay wants to talk to me, why doesn't he pick up the telephone? He doesn't need to go through this. So, yes, Portland, we do have a problem, and it's a problem that is growing in Washington, but guess what? It affects all of you, even here in Portland. The nation's capital is virtually in a vice grip by the so-called religious right, also known as the pro-family movement in the United States. The president kowtows to virtually everything that the religious right says, and on the other end of Constitution Avenue, the House and the Senate are virtually controlled, by ultra-conservative religious right advocates who kind of fall over each other trying to determine which one will bring more of the agenda of the religious right to the floors of the House and Senate. So this has really become a very, very serious problem. Some of the most important lobbyists in Washington these days are not the people with big company money, but the leaders of the religious right. And the religious right, by the way, is not every Republican. And the religious right is not every evangelical Christian. And we need to understand who the real problems come from, or where they come from, and also not make overly broad generalizations about where people come down on these core issues, regardless of their party or what, if any, religious affiliation they may have. The two problems we can make, two difficulties we can encounter when we're dealing with the so-called religious right. One is to not treat them seriously enough because they do say and do some really strange things. But the alternative problem is sometimes we treat them so seriously that we think they are invincible, that if they come to town, if they have a bill they want to pass, there's nothing in the world we can do to stop them. Both of them are very serious errors with tremendous threats that those errors cause to the constitutional rights of a lot of people. Okay, of course, on the first front, not taking them seriously enough, they certainly give us a lot of ammunition about that. Reverend Pat Robertson just 2 months ago, of course, announced on his nationally syndicated television program that it was his view that the United States should take out the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez. Now, to his credit, Pat Robertson 2 days later announced that simply because he'd used the words take out, that did not necessarily mean kill or assassinate. I was comforted by that because I didn't know that preemptive assassination was a biblical construct, although I might have slept through that class in seminary myself. He said, no, I didn't mean kill necessarily. I guess we're supposed to assume the president of the United States would simply try to seduce Hugo Chavez by taking him out for a date, perhaps to the multiplex, and then later to a romantic candlelight dinner. But I'm not buying that. How about James Dobson? He's a little closer to here. Yeah, I know. He's in Colorado Springs. He's the founder of Focus on the Family. He's the guy that spun off a group called the Family Research Council, one of the most important religious right lobbying groups in all of Washington. James Dobson got in the news a few months earlier than Reverend Robertson did because he was a little upset over a tolerance video. A tolerance video that was going to be shown to young people, very young children. This video featured the character known to any of you that have children or grandchildren or those of you who secretly watch PBS, SpongeBob SquarePants. Now, what was the problem there? Well, SpongeBob SquarePants lives in the ocean and he lives with other species. And in the tolerance video, he was going to be like visiting with species on land and in the air. And I assume that Dr. Dobson thought, well, there could be some biblically inappropriate species interrelationships going on, and that might be why you should get rid of SpongeBob SquarePants' tolerance video. But, of course, what he was really trying to say was the very idea that a sponge is going to live in the proximity of other species, that could give young people the nasty idea that straight people could live with gay people. You wouldn't want that happening even in an animated cartoon. So this is the kind of stuff that is the grist of late-night comics. This is the kind of stuff that keeps Jon Stewart, who is very funny, by the way, on his own, but if he just used the material from the religious right, he'd still be funny. The problem is sometimes when you look at the funny, strange, bizarre things that the religious right says and does, you ignore some of the more important things that they say and do and some of the power that they actually exercise. Because when all is said and done, this so-called religious right, 17% by their own self-definition of the American electorate, have some very dangerous and very strange ideas about what the Constitution means and how it needs to be applied to individual freedom, whether those are women's rights or the rights of religious minorities or non-believers or anyone else who finds her or himself in the minority in America. Brother Robertson, for example, just to give you an idea of the seriousness behind some of his comments, some years ago he announced that he was opposed to feminism. He said he would not embrace feminism until there was a master chess champion who was a woman. Yeah, well, at the time he said that, there actually had been already a master chess champion who was a woman. There were a couple of others subsequently, but the last time I asked, he had not checked out any Gloria Steinem books from his local library. So he really hasn't become a feminist. And he doesn't take women seriously. And that's one of the reasons why the religious right has such a great deal of difficulty with issues like moral decision-making by women about their own reproductive health and futures. They devalue women. They devalue people who do not see the world precisely as they see it. Jerry Falwell, remember, criticized whole groups of people the day after September 11th by saying that the presence of people who provide abortions and civil libertarians and feminists caused God to lift the curtain of protection from America and to allow the terrorists, these are Falwell's words, to give us probably what we deserved. Now, you know, in a normal circumstance, a guy like that would be relegated to the far edge of the park. But he's not. He's still the primary voice of American religious thought on national television throughout the United States. And that creates a problem, because then everybody thinks if you are a person of faith, you are Jerry Falwell or closely related to him. Now, the only institution in Washington that isn't under the control right now of the religious right is the United States Supreme Court, but it's getting there. I was truly appalled by the debate over John G. Roberts, a man who should never have been elevated to sit as the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. There was, unfortunately, very little time and attention paid. It was summer. A lot of people just didn't want to bother to look into his record. And after all, how much worse could he be than Chief Justice Rehnquist? We may find out about that, because Chief Justice Rehnquist, for all of his problems, was one of those people who actually thought that states and state supreme courts had the right to interpret their own constitutions, even in ways that he might not have done so himself. That's a big difference. I'm not sure John Roberts believes that. And then I really hated the fact that there were so many members of the United States Senate who actually said, well, we're not sure about Roberts, but we're going to roll the dice and take a chance. You know, folks, you roll a dice in board games. You do not roll a dice when what is at stake is the fundamental religious and civil liberties of America. We're not playing Monopoly. And the people who use that analogy, and who are some of whom are thinking of using it again in regard to the current nominee, these are people who honestly, 78 members of the Senate apparently thought rolling the dice was a good idea, even though the risks of so many of us were at stake. Then, of course, we went through that absurdist period, the period when Harriet Myers was being touted as the next justice for the United States Supreme Court, the most qualified lawyer in America, according to the man, the president, whom she had earlier called the smartest man she ever knew. You see, this is a problem. If you don't get out much, you say things like that. That nomination, whatever we would have found out about Harriet Myers, we won't, because that was torpedoed not by the left, but by the religious right. See, because the religious right, they don't play board games. They don't take any chance. They don't care that Karl Rove was personally picking up the telephone and saying to folks in the religious right, like James Dobson, trust me, she's one of us. She is an evangelical. She is going to a conservative church. That church is virtually universally pro-life. That wasn't enough. They needed to see the goods. They needed to have it proven, and it wasn't. They demanded that the president get rid of Harriet Myers, and the president, true to form, got rid of Harriet Myers. So now who do we have? Now we have a Third Circuit Court of Appeals judge named Samuel Alito. Many groups have already come out in opposition to him, and for good reason. A lot of folks, though, are saying, well, the hearings on Judge Alito, possibly next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Alito, they're going to be held in January. And we're seeing a lot of pundits, you know, of whom I am occasionally one, but, you know, I try to wash my mouth out after I appear on many of those programs, particularly on the Fox News channel. The pundits are saying, and they're writing in your local papers, and your legal writers or professors, they all say, well, we're liberals, but we want to take a very close look at Judge Alito. We want to look at all 350 of the decisions that he's written because we think he's not necessarily a fringe candidate, as one of them put it recently, not necessarily a fringe candidate. Maybe he was just following precedent. Maybe he has an independent view of the Constitution and blah, 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 blah. Now, folks like myself have to read all that stuff. And I will do that. A lot of senators are continuing to say, because there's not been one senator who has come out against him yet, they're saying we must not prejudge him because we have to wait, too, for those hearings in January. Folks, if you wait for the hearings in January, it's way too late. Because the hearings in January are going to do for Sam Alito what they did for John Roberts, give him an opportunity to be carefully coached, probably by an actor like Fred Thompson, who did the Roberts nomination. And the folks asking questions will have 5 minutes, and they'll spend 4 of those minutes running for President of the United States, and we won't learn one blessed thing more than we know about now about someone like Sam Alito. That's the truth. And if senators, including the senators you've got here, say, well, we're going to have to wait, remind them that if, in fact, they wait too long, we might as well just give a free ticket right now to Samuel Alito to move from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., because that's where he's going to sit on the United States Supreme Court. And my standard, you know, people have different standards. Well, what kind of person should be on the Supreme Court? Here's my standard. Sam Alito is 55 years old. If by now he hasn't done one blessed thing to significantly improve the civil rights and civil liberties of Americans, then he does not deserve a promotion to the United States Supreme Court. And that's my standard, and that's what we ought to have as the standard. And you know what? It may come down to the filibuster. The civil F word, I call it, to distinguish it from the uncivil F word that Vice President Cheney used to describe Pat Leahy, Senator of Vermont, about this time last year. Filibuster is not a dirty word. We need to start working right now to let the American people know that this is a way that we have to protect the rights of minorities in this country, that extended debate to stop terrible candidates or terrible ideas is nothing to be ashamed of. It's something to be valued as a way to protect us here in 2005. One of the people I like the most in all the years I've been in Washington was the former Republican senator from the state of Connecticut, Lowell Weicker. He went on to be an independent governor of the state of Connecticut. I still talk to him every once in a while. When he was in the Senate, he didn't mind talking about filibusters or long chats. In fact, every once in a while, he would call me up at home, and I'd usually be asleep. And he'd call up late at night and he'd say, Barry, you know, we're still in session over here and we're talking about a 400-page tax bill and you're probably not watching. And I go, that's right. And then he'd say, well, on page 350 on line 12, there's an issue here that I think violates the First Amendment. What do you think? And he'd read it to me. And I'd go, oh, Senator, you're on to something very serious. This violates the Constitution. He'd slam down the phone. Then I'd have to get up out of bed, turn on C-SPAN 2, watch the Senate. I'd see him coming up, talking to the presiding officer, always addressed as president. Mr. President, I have consulted with counsel. And then he'd say, we got a choice. We can talk about this issue for a very long time, or we can delete these sentences from this 400-page bill. You'd be amazed at how many sentences disappeared just because he had the courage to stand up and say, I will not let this pass. We need a lot more senators, and on the Alito nomination, a lot of senators, starting with the first one, right now, to say, he shall not pass. He shall not pass. You know, I don't know if we're going to win. I don't know if we're going to win. Maybe it's hopeless. But I do know this. It's hopeless if we don't fight. And so much of what happens in America that is wrong with the direction this country is taking in a lot of parts of this country is because people do not get up early enough and stay up late enough to fight the battles that need to be fought for the preservation of these basic principles. I mean, it's hard work, but that's what we've got to do. I don't know what's going to happen with Sam Alito. I know what should happen, but we also have to be careful that in the event that Mr. Alito gets to the court, in the event that he replaces Sandra Day O'Connor, who's a moderate, I mean, you know, some days she even seems like a liberal in her opinions, if he replaces her, we are going to have to make sure that the United States Congress doesn't pass too many bad laws that have to be judged by this increasingly conservative Supreme Court. So we have to stop the bills from passing so that they never get there in the first place. And I just want to talk about a couple of those bills, some of the ones that are particularly odd. The religious right doesn't like the legal system in this country very much. They're constantly criticizing it. So they have designed something called court stripping, which actually is not as interesting as it sounds at first blush. You know, court stripping means you take away the jurisdiction of federal courts to hear core constitutional issues. And you relegate them to state courts. You got some pretty good state courts here. But some states do not have quite the quality of state courts you have here. And under this assumption about the Constitution and the separation between state power and federal power, effectively, core constitutional principles would be removed from the jurisdiction of the court. A couple of examples, same-sex unions, couldn't have that in federal court. Religious displays and public property, couldn't have that. Ultimately, reproductive choice issues would not be in the federal courts. They'd be up to the will of sometimes elected state courts around the country. And fundamental constitutional rights would change as you move from one across one boundary, from California to Oregon. That's absurd. That's judicial anarchy. That is not what the framers of the Constitution had in mind. But it's something very seriously discussed. And in a few test votes, the House of Representatives has actually voted to remove jurisdiction on some of these issues from the federal courts already. They're just getting warmed up. And if you think that's a bad idea about punishing courts, taking away their jurisdiction, they've got other ones so phantasmagorical. I don't know where that, I think that word comes from the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe or something. But those ideas that would never have been spoken, taken remotely seriously a few years ago, some of these ideas are back and they're even stranger than court stripping. How about this? If you don't like the decisions of a circuit court, for example, like the dreaded Ninth Circuit, always referred to on the Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity shows as the most frequently overturned federal appeals court, the Ninth Circuit. If you don't like him, you have to pay salaries to federal judges. Constitution requires that. But the Constitution doesn't say you have to buy their pencils or their computers or pay for their law clerks. So you would actually take away all of the funding that was not directly the salary of the judge. Of course, that would make it impossible to do any kind of real business in the courts, but that is the intention. And the highest level, if you read the Los Angeles Times a few months ago, we had a little tape of this happening. Here's Dennis Hastert and Tom DeLay and leaders of the Senate talking about this as a possibility. That's how extreme a lot of the members of the House and Senate have become in their hatred of the so-called black-robed judges, unelected black-robed judges that they sneer about. Well, you could say, well, at least they're consistent. They don't like federal judges. But wait a minute, then you'd be wrong, because they're not consistent. Because earlier this year, just this spring, you may remember what Congress did in the case of Mrs. Terri Schiavo of Florida. Mrs. Schiavo was, according to a lot of the people that I yabbered with on cable television over the course of those weeks, a woman who was being murdered by her husband. And that is a position. The removal of feeding tubes is considered murder, at least by the late Pope John Paul II, when he was still with us and when he was writing letters to so-called pro-life groups. But the fact is, Catholic moral theology or anybody's interpretation of the scripture is not the way we interpret constitutional rights in the United States of America. We have to get over that idea. American law has resolved and had resolved the important issue of whether
Hi, this is Kenneth G.
Shall not pass. You know, I don't know if we're going to win. I don't know if we're going to win. Maybe it's hopeless. But I do know this. It's hopeless if we don't fight. And so much of what happens in America that is wrong with the direction this country is taking in a lot of parts of this country is because people do not get up early enough and stay up late enough to fight the battles that need to be fought for the preservation of these basic principles. I mean, it's hard work, but that's what we've got to do. I don't know what's going to happen with Sam Alito. I know what should happen, but we also have to be careful that in the event that Mr. Alito gets to the court, in the event that he replaces Sandra Day O'Connor, who's a moderate, I mean, you know, some days she even seems like a liberal in her opinions, if he replaces her, we are going to have to make sure that the United States Congress doesn't pass too many bad laws that have to be judged by this increasingly conservative Supreme Court. So we have to stop the bills from passing so that they never get there in the first place. And I just want to talk about a couple of those bills, some of the ones that are particularly odd. The religious right doesn't like the legal system in this country very much. They're constantly criticizing it. So they have designed something called court stripping, which actually is not as interesting as it sounds at first blush, you know. Court stripping means you take away the jurisdiction of federal courts to hear core constitutional issues, and you relegate them to state courts. You got some pretty good state courts here, but some states do not have quite the quality of state courts you have here. And under this assumption about the Constitution and the separation between state power and federal power, effectively, core constitutional principles would be removed from the jurisdiction of the court. A couple of examples, same-sex unions, couldn't have that in federal court. Religious displays on public property, couldn't have that. Ultimately, reproductive choice issues would not be in the federal courts. They'd be up to the will of sometimes elected state courts around the country. And fundamental constitutional rights would change as you move from one across one boundary, from California to Oregon. That's absurd. That's judicial anarchy. That is not what the framers of the Constitution had in mind. But it's something very seriously discussed. And in a few test votes, the House of Representatives has actually voted to remove jurisdiction on some of these issues from the federal courts already. They're just getting warmed up. And if you think that's a bad idea about punishing courts, taking away their jurisdiction, they've got other ones so phantasmagorical. I don't know where that, I think that word comes from, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe or something. But those ideas that would never have been spoken, taken remotely seriously a few years ago, some of these ideas are back and they're even stranger than court stripping. How about this? If you don't like the decisions of a circuit court, for example, like the dreaded Ninth Circuit, always referred to on the Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity shows as the most frequently overturned federal appeals court, the Ninth Circuit. If you don't like him, you have to pay salaries to federal judges. Constitution requires that. But the Constitution doesn't say you have to buy their pencils or their computers or pay for their law clerks, so you would actually take away all of the funding that was not directly the salary of the judge. Of course, that would make it impossible to do any kind of real business in the courts, but that is the intention. And the highest level, if you read the Los Angeles Times a few months ago, we had a little tape of this happening. Here's Dennis Hastert and Tom DeLay and leaders of the Senate talking about this as a possibility. That's how extreme a lot of the members of the House and Senate have become in their hatred of the so-called black-robed judges, unelected black-robed judges that they sneer about. Well, you could say, well, at least they're consistent. They don't like federal judges. But wait a minute, then you'd be wrong, because they're not consistent. Because earlier this year, just this spring, you may remember what Congress did in the case of Mrs. Terri Schiavo of Florida. Mrs. Schiavo was, according to a lot of the people that I yabbered with on cable television over the course of those weeks, a woman who was being murdered by her husband. And that is a position. The removal of feeding tubes is considered murder, at least by the late Pope John Paul II, when he was still with us and when he was writing letters to so-called pro-life groups. But the fact is, Catholic moral theology, or anybody's interpretation of the Scripture, is not the way we interpret constitutional rights in the United States of America. We have to get over that idea. American law has resolved and had resolved the important issue of whether, under law in the state of Florida, Mrs. Schiavo's will was being exercised after 15 years of litigation in 13 different state courts, and her husband was merely exercising her will at the time that she was competent to make a decision. Well, that's not the way folks on the religious right saw it. All of a sudden, they didn't like what state courts were doing anymore. They wanted to federalize the issue. So, of course, Tom DeLay and Bill Frist brought to the Congress, brought Congress back a day early from their district work period in order to vote on a bill that did pass and that purported to take the entire right to die case of Terri Schiavo and put it back in the federal system and start it all over again. Another 15 years of predicted discussion and deliberation over the fate of this woman. Well, they got that bill passed, although the federal courts eventually said that the Congress had effectively no jurisdiction to do such a thing, to transfer this case into the courts. But what I found most fascinating about that case was that Tom DeLay, in particular, made this such a high priority for him. He went to the Family Research Council, that group that's a spinoff of Focus on the Family, went to the Family Research Council convention, that happened to be held a few days earlier than he was calling the Congress back. And Tom DeLay said, look, I want to help you because I am just like Terry Schiavo. No, he did. He said, this is the analogy he used. He said there's a syndicate, that was the word, syndicate of leftist do-gooders who were responsible for putting Mrs. Schiavo in that place and also causing him ethical problems. I'll help the right, he said. We have a tape to prove it. You may have seen it on twice, 2 days in a row on the front page of the New York Times. He basically said, look, I'm going to help you. But I may need your help, too, so I hope I can count on that. And they all applauded. And the strange thing happened, though. The American people stepped into this debate. And they were asked by pollsters, what do you think of Congress getting into the middle of this decision about the end of life and the care that should or must be given? 80% of Americans in the CBS national poll said Congress should never have intervened in Mrs. Schiavo's case. I have not heard 80% of the American people agree about the fact that the sun will come up tomorrow. So it was pretty powerful. I was on Crossfire. That was still on the air at the time. And I was on Crossfire, and there was some guy from one right-wing group who said, this just showed that Tom DeLay doesn't look at the polls. Tom DeLay is a man of principle. I said, look, if Tom DeLay had seen these polls a week ago, he'd have been on a fact-finding mission to Mars instead of calling people back to the Congress to vote on this issue. He thought he was on the right side of where the right stood, and it turned out he wasn't even there, because in all of these polls, even people who self-characterize themselves as Christian evangelicals by about a 53-57% majority said even they didn't agree that Congress had done the right thing. And I don't think we should ever let that image drop. When people in the so-called pro-family movement, when somebody says, well, that Dobson fellow, he's not that bad, we need to say, yes, he's a part of a phony pro-family movement. First thing they want to do is define what a family is. And then they want to decide how everybody's family, not just their own, can live from the moment of conception until the moment of death, and they will determine when that moment is. And if that's not a scary idea, I don't know what is. And the image of Tom DeLay in or out of prison uniform coming into the sick room with your grandmother saying, I don't think you can do that. Or Bill Frist doing long-distance diagnosis of tapes that were 4 years old, standing there and saying, you know, I've examined those tapes, and she can recover from this. I mean, why would we want to substitute the medical judgment of a guy who was 979 miles away from Mrs. Schiavo's bed? Why would we want him to make decisions about one of the most intimate decisions any family ever makes? Let's keep that up. Keep that image in mind. And I think a lot of folks in the middle of America say, this is not what we had in mind. This is not what we thought the pro-family movement was all about. But they do have a good use of language, don't they? I mean, they're pro-family, that sounds good. They're pro-dog, I think, that sounds good, too. And they also like something called the faith-based initiative. Now, the faith-based initiative is something the President of the United States announced about 5 years ago. It still has not been passed by both the House and Senate because it's so controversial. But the president's been able to eke out some money from a kind of executive slush fund. And by changing executive orders and some regulations and government bureaucracies, he's been able to get some money to these faith-based organizations. At the time that it was announced 5 years ago, I said to some reporter, this is the worst idea since they took King Kong from Skull Island and moved him to New York City. Turns out to be worse. I'm apologizing to the Kong family publicly almost every speech I give. Also want passes to the movie, in case you're connected to it. Here's what it does. Yeah, it's a pretty simple idea. We've had it for a long time. If you give money to a group, a grant to a group, among other things, they don't get to discriminate in the hiring of the people that are being purchased, whose services are being purchased by your tax dollars. They got to go through a process of finding people who are competent. They can't use race. They can't use religion as the basis for selecting people. Not so in the president's vision of the faith-based initiative. He actually believes that people who are receivers of tax dollars, if they are religious organizations, are allowed to discriminate on the basis of religious belief or religious affiliation. That turns civil rights law on its head, civil rights law that's been in effect for government grants and contracts since Harry Truman was president. He wants to reverse it. And we've had to litigate this, and we're involved in a couple of major lawsuits that have been dragging on now for years and years and years over this simple premise that if you get government funds, you should not be able to discriminate on the basis of religion. We just filed a lawsuit in Pennsylvania involving a prison rehabilitation program, and the prison rehabilitation program there is 90% funded with tax dollars from the local government, the state government, and the federal government. Yet they maintain a position, as they articulated in what we call the last straw want ad, that is what we, right before we filed the lawsuit, and we're absolutely sure we'd do it, they were trying to hire an administrator for this program, and not hiring the pastor for some program. They're hiring an administrator, and they put right in black and white in the local newspaper that only Christians would be considered for the job. When I used to say that you could do that, and people say, oh, that's all theoretical, it's not theoretical. Here's another thing that's not theoretical. It's not theoretical that this money, the little money that the president's been able to eke out, tends to go to the what I call FOGs, Friends of George. These are people who have supported him over the years, and now they're getting some kind of payback. The Reverend Pat Robertson, for example, hardly a poor man. I should say he has a $1 billion endowment at his Regent University in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Nevertheless, he at first was very, very much opposed to the faith-based initiative. He wrote an op-ed piece for, the Wall Street Journal, in which he said, churches that take government funds will find it to be a narcotic. They will regret the day they took it. Then, of course, Brother Robertson was offered $500,000. He took it. He hasn't criticized the program since, suggesting to some of us that when you have a prophetic voice, but the prophet's megaphone is being paid for by the government, the prophet is more likely than not to stop criticizing the person who's paying for that megaphone. And that's exactly what we saw here. The Reverend Herbert Lusk, if you're really a football follower, A, you wouldn't be here because you'd be watching Monday Night Football, but B, you might know Herbert Lusk. He used to play for the Philadelphia Eagles. Now he's Pastor Lusk. Pastor Lusk has got a big inner-city church in Philadelphia. He received one of the largest single grants from the president's faith-based slush fund, $1 million for his ministry. So people, you know, heard about this, and most churches and most community groups that had asked for money didn't get anything, and they wondered why he got $1 million. Well, I'm not going to say that this is necessarily the cause, but Herbert Lusk was a man who at the first Gore-Bush election was shown via satellite to the Republican National Convention. And at that time, he was standing behind his pulpit in Philadelphia, and he said a prayer, and then he said, and on behalf of myself and my entire congregation, we support George Bush for president of the United States. Well, he got a payback, didn't he? I mean, it could have been a coincidence. Could have been, but I'm not buying that either. Of course, this was just a payoff. It's the same thing as walking around money in Chicago when Democratic politicians used to go up to ministers and say, hey, get your congregation to come on and vote for the Democrats. We'll give you a few bucks to do it. I mean, it was bad then. It was a corruption of the system. This is a corruption, too. And if you look at the funding patterns of the faith-based initiative, you find more and more money going to those states that are closely wavering between red and blue, ones where this kind of money makes a difference in bringing out voters who want to thank the president. And that's a national scandal that has been underreported in the papers and news magazines of the United States. Now, this is bad stuff. Can we beat it all? Is it terrible stuff? And it is. Here's why I'm what I call realistically optimistic about why we can defeat the worst of these ideas. Because I don't want to come here and tell you how bad things are in Washington, how it's hopeless. I mean, I'd rather be watching football than doing that. People of this country do have a memory if you remind them of things, including that image of Mr. DeLay. And I do think we need to constantly focus on those sad examples of how the religious right has gone too far. When the religious right in your community starts talking about taking the Harry Potter books out of your public library, that's a good thing to point out to the local press because it sounds a little weird. And then when you read some of their criticisms, you know, I guess you think you know why they're against Harry Potter books, because they deal with demonic activity. And that is true. They are worried about that. But the Reverend Lou Sheldon from the Traditional Values Coalition, headquartered down in California, of course, in California, he has actually said that the Harry Potter books prepare young people for homosexuality and abortion. Yeah, see, just guys like you. You see... If you'll take that yellow card and pass it on before everybody else does, we're sending it to the Attorney General. And you're going to get a sweepstakes invitation. Actually, I just thought of it. You're going to get a sweepstakes invitation. It says, you, sir, are invited to come on a special holiday to Guantanamo. That's what's going to happen. No, but and here's the I don't know. Maybe J.K. Rowling is writing a book called Harry Potter and the Morning After Pill. I don't know. I don't think so. But this is the kind of wacky stuff they say all the time. And because they say it, we need to use it as a way to point out just how severely out of touch with regular people this organization, this organized religious right is. Here's the second reason for some hope. Listen to some of these numbers. Remember after the election, the values voter controversy, that 22% of Americans who voted for George Bush mainly voted for George Bush because they considered them the issues of moral values to be the most important measure of why they voted. Well, this made a lot of people apoplectic, particularly Democrats. They all of a sudden forgot they ever had a value. They said, oh my goodness, we have to learn how to quote the Bible more. Some of them have learned that has not improved public policy because we don't have a system of government in the United States where the liberals quote part of the Bible and the conservatives quote the other part, and then one of them wins on the basis of scriptural text. That is some other country, but it ain't the United States. And we have to make sure that progressive people don't fall into the same nonsensical pattern as conservative people do about it. But listen to these numbers. You want numbers? Just a poll last week, 53% of Americans said Roe versus Wade should not be overturned by the next appointment to the United States Supreme Court. New math, old math, that's a majority. 60% of us already approve of same-sex marriage or at least civil unions, a majority. 70% of us think that tax-exempt churches should not be allowed to spend their money on partisan political endorsements like Mr. Lusk did in support of George Bush. 67% of us already believe that a person's religious affiliation should be irrelevant in hiring any positions funded with tax dollars. Now, that would suggest we've already convinced the hearts and minds of people that we're right on these really important core civil rights and religious liberty questions. Apparently, what we haven't done is convinced our feet of those people to take their hearts and minds to the appropriate polling place at the right election. But we can do that if we just work a little harder at doing it. The third reason I have some real hope about what's going on is that we have been beating back some of these same bad ideas for the last 5 years and 10 years. Some of these ideas about changing the judiciary were ones that people like Senator Jesse Helms, remember him? He was fighting for. Phyllis Schlafly was fighting for. These are issues that haven't gone away, but we beat them back before, and I think we have every capacity for doing that again. And the we is not just Americans United, but it's humanist organizations like Humanists of Portland. It's groups like the Council on Secular Humanism. It's groups like the United Church of Christ and the Presbyterian Church. It's groups like the American Civil Liberties Union. All of the groups, and Now, and Feminist Majority, and all the groups many of you are members of. Collective action on the part of citizens has had a very positive effect on stopping these worst ideas from happening in the past, and we have to know that if we apply ourselves in a wise fashion, we can do the same thing again. There's simply too much at stake. There's too much at stake to let Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and James Dobson and Tom DeLay define America, all of its values, and what its Constitution means. You know, during the last months that Dr. Martin Luther King was alive before his assassination, he used to say something in most of his speeches that I think is terribly important for people like us to realize and to remember every day. Dr. King said the arc of change, that is, the arc of change, is long, but it tends toward justice. And I do believe that the history of the United States, with all of its faults and occasional flirtations with doing the wrong things, is a country that is dedicated to finding justice. And it's people like those of you in this room who are working for the causes and in the institutions with your time and talents and resources to make sure that our arc keeps moving in exactly the right direction. So I always like to applaud you and applaud the work that you're doing in local cities all over the United States, even in these times when things look very repressive. Because I'm convinced with a core of people like this, we will teach Americans that they are not like lemmings. You know, those animals that go to the edge of the cliff and the leader jumps off, so they do too. We're not that way. We Americans have this native sense, I think, that's very important. We get to the edge of the cliff, we look down, we say, it's a long way down there. Maybe we should take a step back, take a breath, and start to think what America really means for everybody of every color and creed and religion or non-religion. And then we're going to go and think that maybe the framers got it more right than wrong 215 years ago when they created a Bill of Rights that defended the minority against the overarching power of majorities in or out of government to tell all of us what to do, and that we will not scrap that without the biggest fight of our lives. Thank you very much for being here.
Once again, you've been listening to a lecture from Reverend Barry W. Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, recorded November 7, 2005, at Portland State University. This recording was done by Charlie Holzweisig and produced by Kenneth James, both for KABU. You can listen to KABU right here at 90.7 FM or on the World Wide Web at kabu.fm. Keep listening to KABU for your source for news, music, lectures, talk radio, and much, much more.
Stay tuned at 10:30 for Stage and Studio. D-May Roberts features a special live performance by local violinist Aaron Meyer. But first, from Between the Lines, a brief interview with Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen about the cause of energy price fluctuations and the collaboration of the federal government with energy corporations to boost their profits.
After hurricanes Katrina and Rita battered the Gulf Coast, energy costs spiked, with gasoline rising to more than $3 a gallon. But prices have since come down, now ranging between $2 and $2.25 a gallon. Heating oil prices have seen similar fluctuations, but are still at record levels. As winter approaches, local governments and nonprofit community groups are greatly concerned about the high price of heating oil and natural gas, predicting that low-income families will be facing desperate circumstances long before the heating season is over. Allegations of price gouging have outraged many Americans after big oil companies reported record profits. ExxonMobil had third-quarter profits of $9.9 billion, up 75%, and the largest in U.S. corporate history. Together, the major oil and gas companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 Index have earned more than $20 billion, up more than 50% from a year earlier. Record energy profits have led some in Congress to call for a windfall profits tax, while others have asked the oil companies to contribute a portion of their earnings to assist the needy. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program. He explains the cause of the energy price fluctuations and describes the collaboration of the federal government with energy corporations to boost their profits. Companies that, he says, not coincidentally, have since 2001 contributed $54 million to politicians at the federal level, 80% of it to Republicans.
Natural gas and home heating oil prices were on their ways to record highs long before Hurricane Katrina. The hurricane gave cover to a lot of energy traders in New York to push the prices of these commodities well above any previous high price mark. And what that means is homeowners and renters this winter will be facing the highest home heating prices in history. And these high prices are coming at a time of record profits for natural gas and oil companies. And so far, the United States Congress and the White House have failed to provide adequate protections to consumers from these record high prices this winter. In fact, the United States Senate explicitly rejected legislation just before Thanksgiving that would have enacted a new tax on wealthy oil and natural gas companies and used the proceeds to finance an expansion of home heating oil and natural gas assistance for low-income consumers this winter. Public Citizen, along with federal investigations, have clearly documented price gouging and anti-competitive practices by the largest oil and natural gas companies. Those anti-competitive practices directly lead to much higher prices for consumers. And when consumers are paying record high prices, we have also shown that oil companies and natural gas companies are enjoying the biggest profits in their histories. So there's a clear direct connection between the record prices that consumers pay and the record profits enjoyed by oil companies.
So are they doing anything illegal then?
So far, we don't have evidence of illegal behavior. What we do have evidence of are anti-competitive practices that thus far do not violate federal antitrust law, which is why we are calling for strengthening antitrust law to make these types of actions by large oil and natural gas companies illegal.
You've been talking mostly about oil companies. What about natural gas companies and their practices?
For most large oil companies, they have huge involvement in natural gas markets. ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Texaco, ConocoPhillips, Shell, they are all the biggest natural gas producers in North America. So when we're talking, and they also are the biggest crude oil producers in North America. So when you talk about prices of oil and natural gas increasing, that benefits big oil companies because they are involved in both oil and natural gas.
If the sharp increase in gasoline prices was due mainly to price gouging and profit taking, then to what do you attribute the sharp drop in gasoline prices over the past month or so?
Well, actually, I think a lot of it has to do with the political pressure that started to arise. I mean, the prices started to drop as soon as Congress announced that the five CEOs of the major oil and natural gas companies would be brought before Congress. The prices started to drop as soon as members of Congress started introducing windfall profits tax legislation that would tax away some of those record high profits.
So are there any other moves in Congress to cushion the price shocks in heating fuel that are expected this winter?
Well, in the Senate has put together a large spending bill. It's Senate Bill 2020 that the senators included two new tax provisions that would increase taxes on the oil industry by about $4.5 billion over the next couple of years. One of the provisions would actually revoke a big tax break that was just passed by Congress in July in Bush's energy bill. So I think that that tax money coming from the oil industry could be used for rebates. But other than that, we're not seeing any other calls for major investigations into anti-competitive practices on the part of oil companies. We're not seeing any calls for windfall profits tax. So in that sense, the oil industry, I think, dodged a big bullet.
That was Tyson Slocum, director of the energy program at Public Citizen, a Washington, D.C.-based public policy organization. Contact Public Citizen at area code 202-546-4996 or visit the group's website at www.citizen.org.